Case number 22-3052, John Doe et al. Versus City of Mansfield, Ohio et al. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Beck, you may proceed for the appellants.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. May it please the court, Mr. Vesveri, Ms. Zimmerman. The question before the court today in this case is whether the denial of qualified immunity by the district court in a situation where public records were disclosed pursuant to a lawful public records request was appropriate, given the fact that the appellee alleges that some of those disclosed documents were protected as under this concept of informational privacy through the substantive provisions of the 14th Amendment. And the answer to that question from our perspective is no. The decision by the district court to deny qualified immunity was inappropriate, and it's on two grounds. First of all, based on the record, and that's what I think is critical in this case, based on what the record established, not what we now know may have been some of the information, not what the appellee suggests we should have inferred, but based on this record, this information would not have risen to this constitutional dimension that the cases that this court and even some of the other sister circuits have held might fall within this ambit of informational privacy. And I want to talk a little bit about what was actually said, but I'm obviously going to be diplomatic because it's under seal. But the issue in this case deals with three sentences that was within a personnel file that, by all accounts, was over 100 pages. The investigation file itself, which is marked as Exhibit A to the plaintiff's deposition and to other exhibits' depositions, was 49 pages. And this particular three sentences, basically the first sentence demarcated that between 7 and 18 years old, the family had pets. That's the first sentence. The second sentence says something happened with regard to those pets, and the third sentence says this happened on several occasions, and that's it. It doesn't say the adjective describing the frequency.
How would you confront our decision in Block? Would you at least admit that it falls within the language of Block that would trigger kind of a fundamental right? I think that language was sexual or humiliating actions or something to that effect.
Well, the information, the arguments in Block, and I felt that in reviewing this, when we look at the Block decision, which of course we assert is a markedly different concept. I mean, here we had the disclosure of the details, the graphic details of a rape victim, and that was, of course, in response to that rape victim's complaint that the sheriff hadn't taken enough action. And the sheriff had previously determined that this information itself was confidential and prohibited the suspect and her family from actually obtaining this information. The graphic nature of it goes without saying, and of course what this court properly held was that, and the exact quote is, "We conclude a rape victim has a fundamental right of privacy in preventing government officials from gratuitously and unnecessarily releasing intimate details of a rape where there's no penological purpose being served." And I think that sort of encompasses what the court was saying at that time. In other words, this type of disclosure that has this type of graphic detail is something that really should fall within the scope of informational privacy. And then, of course, the court would do a balancing test. And what was properly decided by this court at that time was that because there was no reason to release this information at that time, unlike if it had been a prosecution, this information should have been protected. In this case, there was a compelling interest to disclose the information. And even the district court made that determination in finding that the Public Records Act in Ohio has been extensively litigated. And the courts in Ohio have certainly declared that there is a compelling interest to disclose information. And if there's a question with respect to whether information should be disclosed or not, it's going to fall on the line of disclosure. And I call
that would, so the first, there's two questions. The first question is there a fundamental right to not disclose? And the second question is, can the state satisfy strict scrutiny? And on the first question, Block arguably suggests there's a fundamental right in having anything that is personal or humiliating or sexual not disclosed. And if that is the legal rule that it clearly established, why wouldn't this at least implicate that?
Well, and the answer to that question, Your Honor, I call the court's attention to its decision in Maddox versus Forest Park, which was authored like 8 months later following Block. And in that case, a similar situation where you had the disclosure of documents that had within its context some traumatic event of a child and also some untoward sexual references that would also be humiliating and improper. And even the court, this court even acknowledged that. Basically said that it didn't want to minimize in any way the impact or the humiliating nature, but the court found, this court found, that that information was not the focus of the disclosure, which is identical to our situation here. This three-sentence disclosure was not the focus. I mean, in the record is Mr. Nixon's testimony that he made a public records request because he was interested in finding information about his supervisor, and particularly wanted to know if she had been disciplined as a result of something that he had made a claim about against her. But the focus of the disclosure in this case had nothing to do with this three sentences.
It can't depend upon how long the record is. And, you know, if it's embarrassing, sexual in nature, and it's two lines in 100 pages, you no longer have an interest. I mean, that's part of the job.
I recognize that.
I don't think something should be protected if your record is 100 pages. I mean, if it's 5 pages, but not protected if it's 100 pages.
Well, and I agree with you, and that's why I thought that the court's conclusion in Maddox was important for our discussion here, because that's essentially what the court said, that this information was contained within this large report, but it wasn't the focus. And that is, I think, what the...
I think that's the exact opposite. I mean, there can be embarrassing sexual private information that's not the focus, but it's released. And I just don't see how your right depends upon the focus of the inquiry.
And I understand your point, Your Honor, except that the information that we have on this record, while it refers to something sexual, that you're now asking, I presume, that the public servant now has to make certain inferences to draw on from this information, from this limited information. And I think that sends us into a whole different direction in an area of the law that isn't clearly in a state of flux. I mean,
what you would concede that the three sentences are personal and humiliating, I would think.
I do.
So I share Judge White's concerns that it seems somewhat arbitrary to suggest that the Constitution should draw distinctions between release of humiliating information that is one part of a broader thing and release of humiliating information that is just itself the focus. Why is that the legal rule? Why should we adopt that as a legal rule and not think it's just arbitrary?
Well, because we have very, very limited guidelines. I mean, we have here is a embarrassing statement about something that happened. That refers to a sexual event or events, let's say.
I'm losing the end of your sentences.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
It would be easier for me if you would just either stay near the mic or try to keep your voice up.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. You know, what we have here is a situation where there are references to a sexual event. That's true. But we don't know any more about that. We don't know anything. And when you compare it to the situation in Block, they're completely different. And so we're trying to extrapolate the clear message in Block to a much subtler situation. And I think that's where the problem comes in, because we're not sure what guidance then the public servant would have on this disclosure issue. And I call the court's attention then to the issues that was clearly addressed by the district court in the Summers versus Fox case, where the Ohio Supreme Court looked at essentially the same issue. And in that particular case, of course, that was involving statutory rape, and that was an awful situation. And interesting, in the Summers case, the county was actually, and the victim were trying to prevent the disclosure of this information, and one of the prongs of their argument was block. And the Ohio Supreme Court, in its opinion, basically said that it distinguished block and said that because block was not a public records case, it didn't raise the same issues, and it also, very importantly, then distinguished block from the exclusion for disclosure in ORC 149.43A1V, and that is that sort of catch-all provision.
I was curious. Do you think so? The public records laws say that you do not have to disclose when it's inconsistent with federal law, and that portion of the Ohio Supreme Court's decision, it wasn't obvious to me what it was saying. Was it interpreting the state statute to say federal law does not somehow not include federal constitutional law, or was it actually engaging in a federal constitutional analysis and just saying, well, the disclosure here would not violate the federal constitution, therefore it's not prohibited by federal law? It was not clear to me what, in fact, it was doing, interpreting the state law or interpreting the federal constitution.
I share the court's issue on that question, but my analysis of that question is the court specifically then said Block is not a public records case and did not create a categorical exception to disclosure under federal law required by A1V. And then it refers to the ESPN versus Ohio State case, and that's a FERPA case. And so that case was a situation where federal law prohibited the disclosure of certain information with respect to students. And my take on that is that the court was saying without a specific federal statute that says you cannot disclose this information, you know, the block would not apply to this situation. And of course, the facts in Summers were equally graphic and horrible. And so this sort of brings me to my the next issue of if the court would agree with the district court with respect to whether this information rose to the level of a fundamental right that protected as informational privacy. Is it clearly established? And my point is, and my argument is, it is not. The mere fact that we are having these debates on the minutia of all of this, and where reasonable minds are differing on what it is and how it is.
Can I, before your time is up, and I was curious, in your brief you repeatedly say the city law director, Reimer, and we should reverse for Reimer and for the city. I just wanted to clarify that.
Remy,
you didn't appeal. Remy, I'm sorry, and you didn't appeal the Monell claim.
I did not. I didn't feel I had standing for that. But I thought we're here to discuss solely the qualified immunity issue with Mr. Remy. I see my time is up. I will speak to the court again. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Raymond Gasfari, and I represent the plaintiffs Jane and John Doe in this case. I think this case presents a remarkable convergence of circumstances that favor the decision of the district court. And the first is the information that was disclosed, and we'll talk about that in just a second. But the second is that we start, and this is a qualified immunity case, with the rather remarkable admonition that a panel of this court made 23 years ago at the conclusion of Bloch, where Sheriff Reiber was found to have disclosed information in which there was a 14th Amendment substantive due process right to the non-disclosure of. That's, I'm sure, grammatically terrible. And thus was found to have qualified immunity. And the court said, with respect to this, any future violation will not allow an official such as Sheriff Reiber to claim lack of reasonable notice necessary to sustain a defense of qualified immunity. Which is to say, in 1998, this court closed the door on qualified immunity to the extent that it depended on reasonable notice in cases like this. Now, of course, the entire point of Mr. Beck's argument is, well, what is a case like this? In their brief, they concede that the standard is, as you, Judge Murphy, said, personal, humiliating, and sexual information, information that checks those three boxes. And they've conceded in oral argument today that the information is undoubtedly personal and is undoubtedly humiliating.
What do you make of the fact that after Block, the Supreme Court, in a case called NASA versus Nelson, went out of its way to suggest that this right doesn't even exist? Or it didn't go out of its way. It went out of its way to clarify that it was not saying whether the right exists, and it was just assuming that it did.
When you say, did you say this court or the Supreme Court?
Supreme Court. A case called NASA v. Nelson, it was cited in the reply brief.
I say nothing about that because I'm not prepared to speak to it, but I do say that this court has not since held as much. And the court has, in 2008 and 2011, twice repeated or summarized, restated the holding in Block as to the informational privacy right in information that is...
So you don't think the assumption... I suppose it was just an assumption that the right does not exist, can't trump our case law if we've already said it does.
I think you've spoken to it, and I don't think the Supreme Court has taken that away. I mean, look, this circuit has, amongst all your sisters, one of the most narrowly defined views of this right that exist. And we've recognized that since the beginning of the case, but we've always contended and contend at this moment that as narrow as the right has been defined in the Sixth Circuit, in Block, this case falls squarely within the parameter.
So why... the case is distinguishable from that case because it does involve a duty to disclose under the state public records law. So there's two competing interests. Those two competing interests were not at issue in Block because the prosecutor, whoever made the statement, the sheriff, had no duty to disclose this, and if anything, was disclosing it in retaliation for criticism against the person, the defendant.
Yeah,
we already have Ohio Supreme Court decision. I know it's not binding on us, but we have an Ohio Supreme Court decision that distinguishes Block in this manner. I would think that under your view, you have to suggest that the Ohio Supreme Court essentially engaged in an unreasonable interpretation of federal constitutional law in order for us to rule for you, because isn't that really good evidence that the law is not clearly established, the very fact that the Ohio Supreme Court said Block would not extend to these facts?
I don't think so for several reasons, and this is a long answer, so if you give me a bit of leave. First of all, I think we start with the fact that in Summers versus Fox, the Ohio Supreme Court admits what we all know, that was not a 14th Amendment substantive due process case. It was a public records case. And the Block was not a public records case. It was a 14th Amendment substantive due process case. They are addressing different things which, while related, exist in different magisteria and partake of different rules and different precedents. That's one. Secondly, as the court has indicated and Mr. Beck has admitted, it's not particularly clear what the Ohio Supreme Court was doing with respect to the federal analysis as it applied to the State Public Records Act. I've read it several times, and this is my best guess. What they're saying is that there is an exception under the Ohio Public Records Law that permits nondisclosure of things that are a protected federal privacy right. And in the FERPA case, the ESPN case, they hung that exception on a statutory right. And here they're saying there's no categorical exception that arises from Block. And what I think that means, in good faith, is that if you have a case-by-case decision that's fact-dependent, and so it is a district court or a circuit opinion that depends upon the facts of a particular case, that does not, for the administrator who's handling the public records request, draw a bright line, then Ohio is not going to recognize that sort of precedent as being sufficiently clear to exempt something from disclosure.
But you would agree the facts of Summers are just as egregious.
Yes, but if
if Summers arose in federal court, and you would think that it would be clearly established that there was a right to nondisclosure?
Yes, and I think that could...
What if we read Summers to suggest that they read federal law to include federal constitutional law, and they just didn't think any informational privacy right covered the duties under the to disclose under the public records laws?
Two things, without exaggeration. The first of them, you would be ceding to a state Supreme Court the support.
No, we're not ceding. If it's unclearly established, we're just saying we're not going to interpret the Ohio Supreme Court to be an unreasonable court.
Clearly established, that's the second thing. It's not before us. The district court held that the right is clearly established.
Well, the qualified immunity appeal is before us, and it requires two steps. One is finding a constitutional violation, and the second is finding that the violation was clearly established. And I have a difficult time thinking this violation. A city employee would think that this right is clearly established when the Ohio Supreme Court has told the city employee that it has to be disclosed.
When did the Ohio Supreme
Court? In Summers. There's no way to not read Summers to think that this creates a duty to disclose this information.
Mr. Remy was an assistant law director for 3 years. He was a law director for 10. He was a human resources officer for 7. He drafted the city's human resources and public records policies. He administered them. He testified that the mayor adopted unilaterally his changes as city policy without exception. This was his bailiwick, and yet he did not even consider the existence of the potential of a federal right to privacy other than HIPAA, and could speak to nothing else. He's a very nice man. I deposed him, very candid, charming, but this is an exceptionally big mistake. He didn't give any consideration, let alone give deference to the federal right. If he's taking shelter in what the Ohio Supreme Court is saying he must do, then we've given up the 1983, we've given up the whole 1983 basket.
But the clearly established doesn't look to subjective intent. The clearly established analysis looks to objective circumstances, and would an objective government official think, be unreasonable in thinking there was no duty, or there was a duty to disclose here. And I would think when you don't have a case dealing with this interaction of a state statute that creates a duty versus a federal constitutional right, and Block isn't that case, do you have any other case that implicates this inherent tension between the state public records laws and the federal right to privacy that you can point us to that would suggest that it was clearly established that the federal right to privacy can sometimes trump state public records laws?
No, I have the directly controlling authority that is Blotch, and we stand on that. This court said as much. It's never said otherwise.
Mr. Vasari, I want to go off in just a slightly different direction.
Yes, sir.
Some of the remaining time that you have. I mean, this all starts really with Kallstrom, and then we get to Black, and then we get to Barber. You've already said that the circuit interprets this so-called informational privacy more narrowly than a lot of the other circuits.
Yes.
We're spending all this time trying to figure out whether this case is distinguishable from that case. How narrow is it really? I'm having trouble figuring out, I have really two questions. The first one is I'm having trouble figuring out how you get from that to say that under these circumstances this was clearly established.
Well, we go to that tripartite test, which, you know, Kallstrom restated, I think. It was twice restated. Sexual, humiliating, and personal. And humiliating and personal are given, and I think they conceded sexual in the argument, but let me draw this connection.
Yeah, but Kallstrom, I mean, that has this completely different issue about disclosing information to defendants that could be used to harm police and their family. So, put that off to the side. That sort of tees us off. Then you get to Black. Black is a rape case. It says it's a rape case. Then you get to Barber. Barber seemingly is trying to cabin Black for whatever Black stands for. Putting aside, however, then you end up with that analysis, how does it become clearly established?
What Block does is it brings within the rubric of the sexual, and it uses the sexual nature of rape to bring within the greater notion of a fundamental right of privacy, you know, the clearly established and with the ambit of ordered liberty. This information, something about a graphic act of sexual violation that is so intimate to the person.
You're just ignoring Barber, seemingly limiting Barber. I didn't say that correctly. You're in Barber, they're limiting, it seems to me, what the court said in Kallstrom and Block. Am I reading that wrong?
I think that Kallstrom restates Block, and that Block applies to things that are sexual in character.
All right, so let me go on to the second question, because right. You and I are probably aren't going to get any further agreeing on the first question. It seems like this case is being repled to be something different than it started out. It started out where, as I understood your argument, is that anybody reading this should have understood not just that this involved an act, but that the act wasn't voluntary. The act was caused by sexual abuse.
Correct.
And it seems to me that if that's what it said in that transcript, we'd have a completely different case. But that isn't what it said here. So now you seemingly are getting away from this argument that that anybody should have inferred that nobody would do this on their own. It had to have been coerced, to say we don't care whether it was coerced or not. It simply shouldn't have been disclosed whether it was voluntary or coerced. So am I following you correctly that your thrust is changing here?
No, nothing is changing. There are three aspects to this thing. It is self-evidently sexual, and that should be the end of the discussion. I don't think there's anybody, you know, the fellow for whom this courthouse was named famously said that he couldn't define pornography, but he knew it when he sees it.
You're basically conceding that you don't have to read into this that it was coerced.
It doesn't have to be coerced.
In order to have been a constitutional violation.
Correct. It doesn't have to be coerced.
That's what I want to know.
Just sexual.
All right.
That's all. And if you look at that information and you don't see sexual, I'm at a loss. I mean, I don't know what more I can say.
So basically, if
it was a deviant sexual act.
We agree with you at the end. Anything of a sexual nature then would be encompassed within Kallstrom and Black's right to informational privacy.
Providing that it was also personal and humiliating, so I suppose that the lever there would then be humiliating.
So the circumstances and the context doesn't really matter under your argument, because it seems to me that the circumstances and context are what drove the decisions in Kallstrom and Black and Barber.
The content of the information as opposed to the circumstances surrounding its disclosure. What the city wants to do here is to graft on the gratuitous press conference, the First Amendment retaliation aspect of Block, and say that those are necessary elements. And they can't be necessary elements. They go, if anything, to the narrow tailoring of the justification and the balancing of a compelling interest and the justification for this particular disclosure serving that interest. But the information is antecedently either private and sexual in its nature before the disclosure is made, however it's made, in a whisper or on the evening news. Doesn't matter. The information's characteristics are what they are apart from and prior to the disclosure. They're separate questions.
And what if the information is... And I know, what if the information is relevant to the inquiry?
If the information is relevant to the inquiry, then the question becomes whether or not the disclosure has been narrowly tailored. Here, those three sentences, that drop of arsenic in a pitcher of water, were not at all relevant. But that doesn't necessarily matter. If they had been relevant, then perhaps some or perhaps no redactions would have been appropriate. But here, Mr. Rebbe was aware of the information, made the conscious choice that there was no reason to redact, didn't redact. There was no tailoring at all to the circumstance.
I'm trying to figure out how you would redact those three sentences. I mean, it seems to me either the three sentences are in or they're out. This isn't a case where arguably the city should have disclosed a part of those three sentences, but not their entirety.
My time has expired. Just a few seconds to answer that fully? I think what you hit upon, Judge McKeague, is the notion of granularity. How much is in and how much is out? And the city would tell you that it's all in. You could redact those three sentences and put the rest of the 100 pages out, and that would be narrow tailoring. Maybe sometimes it's the whole three sentences. Maybe it's a few words. It's context-specific. But that's the notion where narrow tailoring comes in. You fit the solution to the problem. No solution here at all.
You're not answering the question. Do you agree that either the three are in their entirety or they're out in their entirety? Or you're arguing that they should have edited or redacted a part of those three sentences?
I think the three sentences are out in their entirety. I mean, that's the way we handled it when the court told us to redact the private parts and file a number seal.
Now, interestingly enough, there's a lot of other things in that transcript that certainly are embarrassing and humiliating.
But they're not sexual. They're not sexual, and that's all the difference in the world. It doesn't check the third box.
I see. So you're arguing that to say it has to be sexual and humiliating and personal.
It's conjunctive because
It can't be just humiliating.
Right, otherwise there's not a fundamental rights analysis. I mean, there's no fundamental right to not be embarrassed in public if you've done something in the past that it's true. But
why is there, is it we have to ask if the disclosure is about something that there is a fundamental right to?
Well, that's how you got to this narrow construction and logic.
Don't we have to ask whether there's a fundamental right to engage in the conduct that you...
No, whether it implicates a fundamental right. And the court wrapped up in the whole notion of rape being something that was inherently sexual, just like the acts here were inherently sexually deviant, things that touched close enough on the fundamental rights of procreation, contraception, the family, they were within the general ambit of those things which implicate a fundamental right to privacy implicit in the concept of ordered liberty. The link...
As long as it's in the penumbras of the...
That's a dangerous word these days, so I'm not going to use just that word, although I will say that there's nothing in Dobbs that affects this, and it's pretty clear on page 71 of the court's majority opinion that it doesn't. The link is pretty clear. The last thing, if I could just... The city has shown no light of day, no principled reason why these acts and this information should be treated differently as a matter of law than the information in Bloch. Not the circumstances of its disclosure, the information itself. They haven't given you a principled reason why these things are different. They're apples and apples, and that's where we stand. Thank you,
counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I always enjoy discussing things in this rest very. I agree with the court's questioning with respect to a clearly established right. I think that's where the case unbundles for the appellee in this situation. I will call to the court's attention with respect to your inquiries, Your Honor, with Summers versus Fox. I mean, what the Supreme Court addressed was the privacy rights under federal law and Marcy's law. So in other words, the court zeroed directly in on this issue and came up with its decision, which we believe distinguished Block, and it at a minimum creates a question of whether this law was clearly established. And we have a very detailed opinion by the district court. We have had a robust discussion here with respect to how all these things play out, and I suggest that those are the very indicia that this right was not clearly established. If this law that is supposed to protect, you know, anyone except clearly the incompetent, as the old mantra goes, this is a very complex issue. I mean, there's a collision between decisions made by the Ohio Supreme Court. The United States Supreme Court has not weighed in completely on this. And now we have this court trying to narrowly fashion this narrow band of protected activity, which in this case, I believe, doesn't rise to that protected status, but at a minimum, there's insufficient law at that time to make this a clearly established right that needs protection. And with that, I'll rest my case and ask the court to reverse the decision of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you for your vigorous advocacy today, and the case will be submitted.